So, Indus Valley ends, as all civilizations do, usually from climate change or something similar. What happened next? Well, unfortunately, they didn't have Wikipedia in those days, so we don't know all that much. We do know that over a period of time, a new people arrived in India, and these people are often called the Aryan peoples, or perhaps better these days we call the Indo-Europeans. And they moved in from the northwest, right? So you can see here the Indus Valley civilization up here in this kind of fertile river valley area up in the northwest. So the Indus Valley, the Indo-European peoples moving in here. You can see that this is largely mountainous regions. Okay, so there's, you know, it's not a casual journey, right? You have to be fairly determined to move down that way. They used to speak in terms of the Aryan invasion, but these days it's more thought of in terms of a migratory period over a long, long period of time. There may well have been invasions at some points of time, but sort of a long-term migration. It seems that the critical technology of the Indo-Europeans was the horse, right? A horse is the weapon of mass destruction, right? You imagine that you're walking around. You know, here I am, I'm a big soldier, I've, you know, walking around with my spear or whatever, and then these, you know, 500 guys on horses come charging at me. Right? And not just the horse, but also the horse-drawn chariot. Yeah? So one guy driving it, another guy with his spear and his bow and arrow, yeah? This is a terrifying technology, yeah? It's so much faster than anything, yeah? Fast, maneuverable, dangerous. And it seems that was the mastery of horses that gave the Indo-European people the sense of power and the sense of what you might even call manifest destiny. And they moved across the world and they ended up as far as, well, these days they're everywhere. Hello, right? And but even in ancient times, they were everywhere from, you know, Sri Lanka in the south to Iceland in the northwest, and to Siberia in the northeast. So these kind of peoples were moving all over this area. Probably, you know, you do find a kind of a language of violence in the Indo-European, sort of the primitive Indo-European language, you know, words like Bahara, for example, where Bahara is Mahabharata and so on. Bahara meaning to bear or a burden, right? So this is one of the primitive Indo-European roots, but Bahara probably originally having the meaning of the booty, right? The loot, right, which you've nicked from all the villages, which you're raiding with your horses, and you stick that on the back, and then you're like, hey, we've got all our loot, all our bhara. Anyway, so the Aryan peoples arrived. Any link between the Indo-European peoples and the Indus Valley peoples is contested. The critical thing here, again, is the horse, right? There's no horses in the Indus Valley civilization, right? So, but horses are all through the Rig Veda. Right? It's incredibly important. So in the one hand, you have this almost completely disparate sort of cultural worlds that these people are living in, and yet there also seem to be some quite fascinating points of connection. So, some people say that there's basically no evidence of any connection. Other people argue that the Indo-European people destroyed the Indus Valley civilization, right? And some people argue, well, it's perhaps, I tend to think perhaps it was maybe a bit of sort of contact and connection. The Indus Valley maybe in decline, Indo-European peoples coming in, and maybe some influence at some stages and so on, but perhaps not all that close. But that's very much an open question historically. Is it just a nice little map of different languages? And we are very lucky this particular map happens to include not just the Indo-European languages, but also Finnish. Ha ha ha. Very good. so we have a Finnish monkey here, so we have Finnish down here, the Uralic languages. Finnish and Hungarian being some of the very few languages in Europe that are not Indo-European. Anyway, so here's the Proto-Indo-European language. You can't really, I've got another map of it a little bit later, but it began around here. And then split off to the European side, Germanic, Italic, Slavic, and so on. And then up here to the Indic languages, Iranian, Persian, and so on down here. Indic languages, Sanskrit, just gives a little mention here. Not much. Pali, I think, is omitted entirely. It's mostly focusing on the modern languages. But anyway, it's just giving you a kind of quite cute little image of that. And here's a not very accurate map of the distribution of the Indo-European languages. I tried to actually find a better map, but it was difficult to find one. I mean, for example, lots of Indo-European languages are apparently spoken in the middle of the ocean here by the Andaman Islanders. And a little finger of Indo-Europeans swimming out here, I guess, when they're thing. But apparently over the whole of Russia, which is in fact a European language, then we don't find anything. So it's not a particularly reliable map. Also, the dates are quite suspect. This is telling us that Indo-European languages arrived in Sri Lanka 500 years ago, which would, of course, be news to any Sri Lankan who will tell you that the Indo-European languages arrived 2,500 years ago. But anyway, a few little minor factual problems here, but this is giving us a general picture that the homeland of the Indo-European language, probably around here somewhere, so they tend to either depict this area, like Turkey area, or up here maybe as the homeland of the Indo-European languages, and that's been tested on both linguistic grounds by tracing the language use and how that evolved, but also these days through genetic analysis as well, to try to identify the homeland of the Indo-European peoples. But in any case, it was probably quite an open grassland area, which is where they first tamed and domesticated the horse, and being the source of their power. And from there, they spread out mainly, as you can see, primarily on an east-west axis. Okay, and those of you who've read Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs and Steel would understand why that's the case. Most of Europe, so Iceland, and much of India, down as far as Sri Lanka, being all Indo-European languages. Okay? So when the Indo-Europeans arrived in India, they either brought with them or they set to work composing sacred literature, which we know today as the Vedas. Now, the Vedic religion bears much in common with religions found in other parts of the Indo-European world. For example, we're used to hearing of the Devas and the Asuras in Buddhism, Devas being the gods, the Asuras being the Titans. Of course, if you know your Greek mythology, you know you have exactly the same division of the gods and the Titans. In Persian mythology, for example, they use the same words for them, the Devas and the Ahura. Except they got mixed up, or they're reversed. So the Ahuras are the good guys, and the Devas are the bad guys. Okay, so they've got the same terminology. Many of the words we even find in Greek mythology are directly related to the words we find in the Indian mythology. For example, one of the famous or one of the powerful deities in the Rig Veda is Dyaus, who of course is in Greece known as Zeus. And so on and so forth. So these are essentially the same mythology, the same religious roots, going out to these different places, and many similarities also in the liturgies and the worship. One of the most prominent and powerful and important aspects of that similarity is the worship of fire. Right? In the Vedas, Agni, the fire god, is incredibly powerful. Right? Fire, the source of energy, the source of heat and light, what keeps you alive in the cold, right? Cooks your food for you, extracts metal from the ground, right? It's the element of transformation. It's the element which takes your corrupt, wet, moist, crappy body and transforms it into energy so that it can ascend to heaven when you die, right? And so these fire rituals are incredibly important for all of the Indo-European peoples. In the World Parliament of Religion. When I was there in Melbourne a few years ago, we had a nice presentation from a Lithuanian gentleman who was a practitioner of their traditional Lithuanian paganism. And Lithuania was one of the last countries in Europe that was converted to Christianity. And he said they were very lucky because they were converted by the Catholics and not the Protestants. Because he said that if you converted to the Protestants, then they made you study the Bible and they made you actually practice things and live as and see life. But the Catholics just wanted you to come to church once a week and they didn't care what you did after that. So they kept on doing their traditional sort of pagan rituals, and the most important one was a fire worship, which is very similar to the Vedic fire worship. Right? So you can see these rituals have a long history. So the Indo-Europeans come into India. They're not one people, right? It's a general cultural category with related language families and rituals and so on, but not like one, sort of cohesive mob, but different peoples coming down at different times, and they kept their own traditions, right? So they had different tribes, or what they call kulas, right? Kulas we translate as a family, maybe a clan or something like that. And so each clan would have had its own secret sacred knowledge, which was the source of the power and so on for that particular clan, right? So you have to understand how important this is. They're getting the favours of the gods because of their special ability to call upon the gods and make the weather and so on work in their favour. And, of course, also to be able to, do a bit of the odd smiting of your enemies and this kind of thing. So they didn't want to share this secret of their power with anybody, and they, in fact, guarded it very jealously. However, around 1200 perhaps to around 850 or so perhaps BC, we had the formation of the first kingdom of the Indo-European peoples in India, and that was around the Kuru country, which is roughly around where modern day Delhi is. And this Kuru kingdom became in the Indian imagination the classical culture, a classical civilization of Indian culture. So the Kuru country, Kuru kingdom, is the classical Indian culture which is imagined by the Mahabharata and the Ramayana and so on. And so this has always kind of informed the idea of what Indian culture should be. We know very little about it in historical terms. There's no real sort of major cities and so on that we find like in the Indus Valley civilization. And so our knowledge of that culture is much more inferential and much more vague, even compared to the Indus Valley civilization. This is roughly where the Kuru kingdom probably was. See the Kuru country here? You can see not far from the Indus Valley. That's Indus Valley, this region. And this is the sort of gradual, the center of culture over this period, like the center, the weight of the center of culture is gradually moving to the southeast, okay, down the Yamuna and Ganges rivers. So here, this kingdom, of course, the Kuru country marking roughly the furthest to the northwest that the Buddha traveled in his lifetime. So, and this was at its height, maybe 400 years or so before the Buddha. And it went into decline after that for reasons we don't really know. These other kingdoms mentioned here are probably somewhat later. Anyway, we find these kingdoms existing in the time of the Buddha and a bit before, but whether they were contemporary with the Kuru country is probably somewhat doubtful. So the main significance culturally of the Kuru country for us was that they created, it seems, they created the Rig Veda. And this is a theory which was proposed by Michael Witzel, a very prominent Vedic scholar, and it seems to be, I think, a very compelling theory. So his idea was that when they formed this kingdom, this Kuru kingdom, they kind of forged a unity out of all of the different Indo-European tribes. And then one of those tribes gained ascendancy, probably by killing most of the rest of them, as I think things usually do. And they, by whatever means, fair or foul, and again, we don't really know how this was accomplished, they collected everything into what we know today as the Rig Veda. The Rig Veda is a very large collection of verses, about 10,000 something verses, okay? So it's a substantial literary work, okay? It's not something which is done by a tribe, right? Tribes don't do that. Yeah, tribes don't have collections of 10,000 verses which are preserved exactly, right? They might have stories and so on which are retold and reimagined, but they don't possess the means and the stability to preserve information with that level of detail over that size of that corpus. So this is something which is done not by tribes, but by kings, right? By kingdoms. They have the resources to do this and stability to do this. So somehow they either persuaded or perhaps coerced the different families to join together, and each one of those families to give up their sacred knowledge, right, to contribute their verses. Maybe they held something back, we don't know. But anyway, they gave up their sacred knowledge, and that comprises the second through eight books in the Rig Veda. Okay, it's what they call the family books. Each one of them attributed to a particular family lineage. Then that collection is like bookended with these new books, the first book and the last two books, which are known as the unity books or the harmony books. And so this is the creation of a literary artifact, right? An astonishing, huge work of literature, right? As the cultural centerpiece for that civilization, right? So they can now say that we are all one. And what this meant was, you know, you find this saying in the Vedas: truth is one, but the sages speak of it by many names. Yeah. And this, of course, encapsulates what's become the essence of Indian philosophy ever since then, right? That you can have all of this diversity, all of these different gods, all of these different things, everything, so much diversity, but actually these are all just different names. And there's one truth. Yeah. And that idea, I think, was first manifested here in the Kuru country. Yeah? All of you different families, all of you different gods, all of you different worship and so on. Actually, we're just worshipping the same God, the same truth. Yeah? And let's bring that all together and we can all be as one. I remember when we were at Wat Manachat once, we had quite a kind of funny incident there, you know, because when Manachat was the monastery in Thailand where I ordained, and it's kind of renowned for being quite a kind of strict, you know, hardcore kind of forest monastery and stuff, and we were having these meetings and everyone was like, you know, everything has to be like this, and it's all kind of really... And then these Sikh guys came in, right? So they just happened to be wandering around Thailand, right? And this Sikh teacher comes in, and he was like this very kind of charismatic... extroverted kind of guy, and he just kind of sits down and some of the monks had a chat with him and so on, and he just saying the most kind of, you know, just here. I remember one of the things that he said was, he said, you know, if you want to meditate properly, first you have to go with your wife and you go and you're happy with your wife, and then when you've done that you go and meditate and you have good meditation. And so we said to him, oh really, he said, you know, because we usually teach that you have to sort of let go of that kind of thing before your meditation becomes peaceful. And his response, I'll never forget his response, was, yes, 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 you are right, I am right too, everybody is right. That's very funny. So this is where this kind of attitude comes from, this very inclusive thing, eh? This Indian thing, everything is right, everything's included. So the Rig Veda was created, it was maintained in the oral tradition for 3,000 years, right? Still memorized in the oral tradition today. I mean, there are manuscripts, and there have been for some time, but it's just incredible. And not just, you know, you have to understand, it's not just vaguely memorized or something, right? It's literally letter by letter. Every sound, every phoneme is memorized with precise, rigorous 100% accuracy. And they did this with all kinds of very sophisticated mnemonic devices. For example, they would learn to recite each verse, each line forwards and backwards, right? So you have to memorize not only 10,000 verses, you have to memorize each line backwards. Okay, so the content of the Rig Veda is actually a new translation of it. It came out a couple of years ago, which I haven't seen, which would be great if it didn't cost like $600 or something. But anyway, it mainly consists of hymns of praise for various gods. There's like fragments of myths and cultural assumptions and ideas which are included or referred to there. But, you know, it's all kind of assumed knowledge, like the background to all of these gods, who they were, what their story was and so on, is all kind of assumed knowledge. And all you find is the actual hymn, which might refer to, you know, something like Indra, who overcome the dragon, Vritta, for example. And then in a couple of, somewhere else it might tell you a couple of details about what happened when Indra overcame the dragon Vritta. And so you learn bits and pieces here and there, but you don't find a sort of coherent account of any of these things. In some of the later books, especially these Unity books that I mentioned before, we find some more philosophical passages addressing questions like where did the universe come from, what's the meaning of life, and these kinds of things. Some short passages, but some quite beautiful and profound ones, but very much the minority. Almost the entirety of the Rig Veda consists of invocations and hymns to the gods in various ways. It's not to say that they're uninteresting. There's many, many fascinating things there. But we won't go too much into the Vedas as such. Action in the Veda, so we've now come on to the question of karma. Karma consists of effective supplications, right? And the important thing here is that God is subject to the ritual. This is absolutely crucial for understanding Indian religion. Right? God is not something who stands beyond the ritual. Right? God is manifested through the ritual. Gods became gods because of doing rituals. Okay? And they are part, what has power, right, is the forces of nature, however you want to conceive that, whether that's conceived as being Brahman, right? In the Vedas they use the word Rita, which is related to the Pali word Utu, meaning weather, right? But Rita meaning something like natural law. Okay? So the gods were subject to natural law. Of course, in Buddhism we would call that Dharma, right? So the gods are subject to Dharma. They are not something who stands outside nature and acts on it, which is the conception in the monotheistic religions. Right? James Frazer, the pioneering anthropologist of religion and magic in the late 19th, early 20th century, made this distinction between magic and religion. I'm not sure whether his distinction is valid anthropologically. He tried to argue that societies sort of began with magic and then moved on to religion. I don't really think that's the case, but I think conceptually it's a useful kind of distinction. And the idea here being that magic magic is basically a conception of how the world works. So magic is like a system of natural laws. And this is why the gods are sort of operating within that mesh of magic. So this idea, we have idea of prayer in the Christian tradition where you say, you know, you first butter up the God, right? So you say, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, yes, please, please. Right? And then give us this day our daily bread, right? Yeah? So you first of all, you put him in a good mood and then you ask for what you want, right? But whether he gives you what you want is entirely up to him, right? Whereas in the Indian sphere, God doesn't have any choice in the matter, right? God is compelled to give you what you want, whether he likes it or not. And this is something which is found again and again in the Hindu mythology, how God is actually compelled by different kind of actions. So this is the idea that, from Fraser's idea, was that religion was this idea of supplication, whereas magic was the idea of invoking some kind of natural laws, right? So whereas in the Indian sphere, I don't think that ritual, that distinction, the conceptual difference between them, I think is important, but I don't think they were ever kind of distinct things. The performance of a ritual is a karma, in fact, maybe even could say it's the karma. Okay, so when you do an act, you get some kind of result of this. And it's one thing that Richard Gombrich talks about, one of the great metaphors in the Indian consciousness was the metaphor of growing crops. Okay, Indus Valley was an agrarian culture. The Indo-Europeans probably were originally pastoralists, but later became agrarians. You have a seed. Right? You throw the seed on the ground. Okay? First thing. Right? Sacrifice. Right? I have to give something up. I can eat that seed. Right? This is rice. This is wheat. This is food for me and my family now. Okay? But I'm going to give that up for the sake of results that I expect in the future. Yeah? Isn't that crazy? Right? I'm just going to take this perfectly good food and throw it on the ground. Yeah? So in order to do that, you have to have a lot of faith in the workings of nature, in the fact that the universe operates in a predictable and consistent manner. Yeah? I've seen this happening so many times. This is the knowledge. This is what's passed down. This is what we do. So we can sacrifice. But then when we've given that up to the soil, the seed then waits underneath the soil, unseen, for a long time. Week after week, month after month maybe. Yeah? It's unseen, but something's happening. Right? Something's happening. It's still there. There's still the seeds there. But we can't see anything. Yeah? But then when all of the conditions are right, the weather is right, the rains are right, the soil's right, everything's right, then we see the fruit starting to appear. Something coming. We get a result from that act. And as that result matures, we see that that's a similar kind of thing to what the original act was, right? So if we sow rice, we get back rice. We sow wheat, we get back wheat. But, also interesting, it's not quite the same though, is it? Because if we put a mango seed, we don't get back a mango, we get back a mango tree. Right? And a mango tree's got a lot more than one mango. Yeah? So the results of the karma, right, of the act is quite disproportionate to the effort, you know, it's aligned with it, but it's much greater than what the cause seemed to be. So as the Buddha said, karma, I'm using Sanskrit for Pali now, I'm getting mixed up in my head, kamam ketam, okay? Karma is the field, yeah? Vijnanam bijam, consciousness is the seed, tanha sneho, craving is the moisture. So this is how those metaphors, that idea of karma as a seed, are still there even within the Buddhist idea. So karma is, basic meaning of karma is work, right? So if you say, I'm going to go off to work today, right? I'm going to say, I'm going to go off and do some karma today. Right? That's what karma is. And it's that idea that you sacrifice, you do something, and you get some result back. Right? And so that meaning of karma became adapted in a religious or spiritual sense to be used for the ritual. Right? So you do some kind of ritual which involves a sacrifice, giving something up, food or rice or ghee or something. Right? Also, of course, slaughter of cows, human sacrifice, right? Ashwamedha, Purisameda. And some result is expected from that. So these rituals pervade the Brahmanical culture, and they're always expected to be efficacious in one way or another. And of course, this is one of the reasons why you have the secretive Brahmanical culture, right? Now, because of course, rituals often don't work, right? I mean, certain kinds of rituals, you see how a ritual goes, right? How do you actually persuade people that your rituals have a power? Right? Well, you do that by doing rituals that work most of the time. Right? For example, you do Om Bhur Bhurvasva Tat Savitur Varenyam, Bhargo Devasya Dimahi Dhyoyo Naha Prachodaya. It's a Gayatri mantra. Yeah? Homage to the glorious rising sun whose divine radiance brings our mind towards awakening, yeah? And you recite that at the dawn, yeah? And it's magic. The sun comes up, right? And you do that every day, and every day the sun comes up, yeah? It's amazing, yeah? And that proves that your magic works, yeah? And then when the rainy season comes, yeah? You come and you do your rituals, may the rains come, yeah? Wow, the rains come. Isn't that amazing? Yeah? And so this is how you kind of build up this expectation of these things. And so, of course, sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes you go out and you do the rainy season ceremony. Everyone's looking up in the sky. What's going on, right? Well, somebody stuffed up, right? The Brahman was impure. The ritual wasn't done correctly, you know. Maybe somebody did something else that was very bad that counteracted it, right? So you kind of build up this expectation of things working, but then they don't always work. But there's certainly this idea that there's a connection. So in the Vedas, in the Vedic literature, the idea of connection is absolutely paramount. And this is something which is drawn out a lot in the later strata of literature, the Upanishads, the notion of sandhi, a hidden connection, right? Everything connected, everything. Yeah, we know this, we hear this idea so much like in modern spiritual things. Yeah? Everything's connected, everything's interdependent. The roots of that idea come back to this Vedic and Upanishadic idea of the sandhi, right? The connection between the self and the cosmos and control over both. So that when we're doing the action, the karma, right, that's what allows you to have control over these hidden connections. Okay? So if I want to have a fertile harvest, right, I do the ritual. So it's not just random, right? Sometimes it's good harvest, sometimes it's not. I want to control that. I do this ritual. Why? Because there's a connection. There's a link between myself and that field. Yeah? So I can do that ritual. And so we find all of these kinds of different rituals. They have, Brihadaranyaka has a series of sex magic. Right? So you can decide I'm going to have a boy or a girl. It does actually give you the option of choosing to have a girl, which is quite astonishing. You can choose the skin color or the particular qualities. I want them to be intelligent or faithful or devoted. And you can do these various kinds of things that will procure the outcome that you want. So this is the notion of karma as that action which is under our control and which relies on the idea that the universe is predictable and interlinked. Okay? Rini.
Just a clarification, when you said earlier that the thoughts are subject to rituals, and you said something like, you
know, somebody is deserving of something, he's got no choice but to give it. Right.
Is that the karma
idea behind
it? Is that what you're
saying,
like deserving of it, so he has to give it?
That's one way of expressing it, yeah. But it doesn't have to be ethical karma, right? Because like these rituals have nothing to do with ethics. Mm-hmm. You can be a really bad person and still do the karma and still get the results you want. Right? So if you want to go to heaven, in the Vedic period, you did the karma of the funeral, your body was burnt and so on and so forth, and then you went to heaven. Yeah? So it had nothing to do with ethics yet. That comes later. Yeah. But you find all of these kinds of things in the Hindu literature, for example, like God sitting up there on his throne, and you get some sort of ascetic or something who's doing some contemplative practice or ascetic practice or something, and then heats up the throne of the king of the gods. So he can't even stay on his throne anymore, right? And so he has to come down and kind of deal with his problem and so on. Yeah, so the gods are subject to the laws of nature, not the other way around.
What you're saying is the karma is the action of doing the ritual. So if
yes.
You do that, then
you'll
get...
Exactly. Oh, yeah. 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 Karma is the action. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So following the Vedic literature, as always, people are never sort of content, but they start writing commentaries, right? A lot of the commentaries on the Vedas are very boring. And that's a literature we call the Brahmanas, which are basically sort of giving details for how to do the rituals and so on and so forth. Are boring for me, I'm sure they're very interesting for Vedic priests and things. But the kind of literature which is much more interesting and much more philosophically important was the literature called the Upanishads. Upanishad means sitting close to, and has this idea of sitting close to a teacher, so you go up to learn from the teacher. It's a bit similar to the word we have in Buddhism of upasaka, right? Upasaka means the same meaning as sitting close to, yeah? So Upanishads started to appear, so notice that you remember that the Kuru Empire sort of disintegrated about 850 BC, Upanishads started to appear shortly after that, okay? So maybe 700 or so BC, a couple of hundred years before the Buddha. We don't have very precise dates on it, but it can't have been much older than that. And the Upanishads, rather than being, they still concern themselves with the ritual to some degree, but they shift the emphasis from the correct performance of the ritual to the understanding the meaning of the ritual, and in many cases go beyond thinking about the ritual at all. So there's a lot of contemplative passages, a lot of very highly symbolic passages, mythological passages, parables. There's a lot of riches of different kinds of things, especially in the early Upanishads. And you have this very questioning and explorative spirit, right? So the Upanishads are not like a set of commentaries which set out to define meaning and to limit interpretation, but the Upanishads are there to blow your mind, right? And they have done that successfully for the last 2,500 years, you know, and even you get down to the modern times, you know, someone like Schopenhauer, for example, who said that the Upanishads were the inspiration of his life, and there will be comfort when he dies. And there's both a rawness and a sincerity and an integrity to the questioning that's going on in the Upanishads, which you find, I think, rarely in religious and spiritual literature. It's a similar flavour to the flavour we find in the Pali Canon. The overriding, most sort of dominant philosophy in the Upanishads is the idea that the self is the same as the Brahman, the cosmic Brahman, Tathāgatāsi, and of course this being, you know, one of the dominant philosophies in modern Hinduism. And we can see how that's continuing, that tendency that we already noted in the Kuru country, a kind of unifying and inclusive tendency, right? So it's about dissolving the boundaries between oneself and the others. So he uses metaphor like the, just as each river has its own name and shape, nama rupa, but when they go into the ocean, they lose their individual name and shapes and they just become one with the great ocean. And so too, this individual self will become one with that great ocean of consciousness, which is the Brahman. The word Brahman probably originally meant something like vitality or magic power. It was the force which gave life to living things. It was the force which gives energy to the universe, and it's the force which can be manipulated through the performance of magic. But by the time of the Upanishads, the notion of Brahman had become much more sophisticated and had become an idea of like a cosmic absolute, the source of being and energy from which the universe springs. Unlike Buddhism, the Brahmanical and Upanishadic literature is very positive. Buddhist texts are always very negative, right? In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it's like the eye is honey for forms and forms are honey for the eye, and this self who lives inside your heart, this man glowing full of light, he is the honey for those things. And the Buddha came along and said the eye is fire, the forms are burning, consciousness is burning. Right? And so from the Brahmanical position, the world is inherently good. Right? It's creation of Brahman. It is how it's meant to be. Even all of the suffering and so on is still meant to be there. You know? This idea of kind of acceptance of all of those things. But at the same time, they're starting to question and to get to this idea of liberation. So here we have the map. This map's not particularly useful, actually, but this is just showing us. Here is the region that we're talking about now. I couldn't find a great map to put this on, but anyway, this is the movement of Buddhism, these yellow arrows, but we're not actually that interested in that right now. But this yellow area here was basically the area where early Buddhism flourished, and it's more or less the same area where the Upanishads also took shape. The same cities, the same kingdoms are found through the Upanishads that we find all through the early Buddhist texts. Okay, so the Buddha was going to the same towns and teaching there. One of the most common teachings we find, phrases we find all the way through the Upanishads, Ya Evam Veda, one who knows this. Right? So you're doing that ritual. How do you do the ritual? What are you doing? One who knows this. Yeah? Right? So if you do the ritual mindlessly, right, carelessly, without thinking, without understanding, then it will have very little benefit. Right? But if you understand what the real meaning of this ritual is, right, then the benefits will be great. And the purpose of doing the ritual is very powerful. Ya evam veda, one who knows this. And knowing this, the understanding, is understanding the connections. Okay? Understanding that that when you are sacrificing the ritual, the horse, right? The horse sacrifice is the first passage in the Briharanika Upanishad, right? And the purpose of the horse sacrifice is to establish sovereignty, kingly sovereignty. And when you're killing the horse, you have to know that every part of that horse corresponds to a part of the universe, right? So even like the urine of the horse is the rains that come down from God and so on and so forth. So every part of the horse corresponds to part of the universe, and you have to know that while performing the sacrifice in order for it to have its proper result. Ultimately, of course, that connection, that sandhi, is tatvamasi, thou art that. This little self is the same as the cosmic Brahman. One of the striking features in the Upanishads is that many of the innovations and the ideas which we think of as most characteristic of Upanishadic thought were introduced by non-Brahmins. Okay? And this is very striking, right? This is one of the reasons why it's a very honest literature, right? This is literature created by Brahmins and passed down for Brahmins, okay? But they acknowledge, actually, a lot of the good ideas that we have were brought by these Kshatriyas, these non-Brahmins, right? Who actually defeated learned Brahmins in debate and whose ideas proved to be very persuasive, yeah? This is quite interesting. It reminds me, it's a bit irrelevant, but it reminds me of the Iliad, which has a similar thing. It's written by the Greeks and it tells it from their perspective, but actually the Trojans are consistently more noble and nicer guys than the Greeks, who are these brawling, drunken bullies throughout the whole thing, right? And the Hector and the Trojans are actually far nicer anyway. So another thing introduced in the Upanishads is the aesthetic ideal. Again, the focus of one of the major dialogues in the Upanishad, the debate or the discussion between Yajnavalkya, the great sage, and his wife, Maitreyi, where he talks to her very much as an equal about the matters of higher significance and greater significance. And he explains to her why he is going to go forth, why he's going to leave his family. And discusses that issue in a very, you know, it's very beautiful and powerful dialogue. It's both very kind of personal and emotional, but also introduces a range of very powerful philosophical ideas. And we find the notion of samsara and liberation, rebirth and liberation, starting to emerge a little bit in the Upanishads, not yet really clearly defined. Briharanika Upanishad is the oldest, the largest, and the most important Upanishad. The other very significant one is the Chandogya, but for now I'll just focus on Briharanika. There are many Upanishads, up to over 100. Most of them were written at a later date. There's about half a dozen which probably were composed before the time of the Buddha. Okay, so the Upanishads is a large literature. Right? They usually talk about, I think, the 10 principal Upanishads, and of those, probably about 6. Existed before the time of the Buddha. The reason we know that is because they're referred to in one of the Buddhist texts, the Tevijja Sutta. Is it 6 or 4? Maybe it's only 4. I should know that. I think maybe it's 4. Anyway, just a few of them, one of which is the Brihadaranyaka, and by far the largest and most interesting. Fascinating text. You all should go off and read it. Okay. Connections, Sandhi, already talked about. And the most important sage in the Brihadaranyaka is called Yajnavalkya. And Yajnavalkya was a great debater, very innovative philosopher, and is featured in a number of very kind of dynamic and very central dialogues in the Brihadaranyaka. There are, of course, many other great sages. Unlike the Buddhist tradition, which is essentially the record of one teacher, okay, and the expression of that, the Upanishads has always had this diversity of whole Brahmanical tradition. It's a record of a tradition of teachers rather than any particular individual. And Yajnavalkya's probably best known phrases, Tatvamasi, I've already mentioned, Thou art that. but also nedi, right? Not that. Yeah? One of his most famous teachings, not that. Yeah? You can see this is like a precursor to the Buddha's teaching of not self. Yeah? So it's this idea of this negative nedi. What did he mean by that? What he means is that we're always attaching to things of little significance in the world. We're always identifying with externals. And we think that these things are so important. We identify with our name. We identify with our body. We identify with our possessions. We identify with our family. We identify with all of these things. But none of those is the essence. Nedi. Nothing that you can see, nothing you can hear, nothing you can think, nothing you can know. None of those things are what the essence is, yeah? But that which is the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the unknown knower, yeah? Yeah, that is your essence, that is yourself, that is your Atman, yeah, that is the Brahman. And so this is the Yajnavalkya's teaching. He dispenses with everything in the world because there's only one thing that really matters, and that is yourself, your Atman. Yeah? Okay, so we've reached the end of the presentation for now. I wanted to discuss some of the Brihadaranyaka passages on life, death and rebirth, but we maybe we'll have to do that this afternoon. So this afternoon we'll look at what the suttas say about these things and also what the Upanishads have to say about it.